Thank you so much for your interest and your attention and your attendance in this series of presentations. It's such a treat to have Brother Joe Price here. Joe and I have been known each other and been good friends for a long time. In fact, he used to preach in Dunes, Texas. I wish he was still in Dunes. And I miss him an awful lot, but he does great work wherever he's been up here in the state of Washington. So what a pleasant treat to have him here. We're going to talk this morning about science versus evolution. A few years ago, my wife and I went to Great Britain. And in that trip, we went to the British Museum of Natural History. And when you walk into that British Museum of Natural History, there is a grand hall, quite an impressive building. And you'll notice in this picture there is a stairway, and at the top of the stairway where people were stopping is a statue of Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin, considered to be the father of modern evolution. Now, he didn't start the theory of evolution. That's been a theory that's been around since the beginning of the world. There's always only been two choices: either God created the world or the world created itself. But Darwin came up with a mechanism that he proposed for survival of the fittest that he says explains how evolution took place. And so he gets a lot of credit for the theory, the modern theory of evolution. You go up the stairs and turn to the left, and you go back and you find a display on evolution there in the museum. You'll notice here there is a statue of a human being along with other primates. It was interesting when my wife and I were standing there looking at this display that there was a man talking to his children and explaining to his children from the display how man had evolved. He was explaining how evolution is taught in the school and teaching his children the very same thing, how we've evolved from these ape-like ancestors. And you can notice here that we have another display, or over the part of the display in the family tree, so to speak. And that is common throughout the world to see museums display this sort of teaching mechanism. Well, on another speaking trip, we went to the Harvard Museum of Natural History. And you walk in the Harvard Museum of Natural History, and similar to the British Museum of Natural History, there is a display on how we evolved from apes and ape-like ancestors, understanding our family tree. It was almost the same thing, but different people. There was a man. He had his boys, and I don't know if they're all his own boys, maybe some neighbor children, but he had several boys with him, and he was explaining to them how we evolved from the ape-like ancestors using this display, pointing out how we came. And so you can see a pretty strong teaching display in these museums, how here's a human being and how we look a lot like in our skeleton to the different primates. Here's the family tree, and this explains how we came into being. And then in that display, there's a statement that says, evolution, like the theory of gravitation, is an essential truth supported by overwhelming scientific evidence. Now, evolution's a theory. But when it's taught, it's sometimes put out to be a fact. Gravity is a fact. You cannot defy gravity. You may do some things to overcome gravity for a period of time, but gravity is a fact. And so when people are teaching evolution, they're putting it on the same par with gravity and other things we know to be true. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to talk about science against evolution. And to do that, what I want to do is I want to start off reading with you the Scriptures. This is really what the debate is about, is it not? Genesis chapter 1. So I want to take just a moment and read with you Genesis 1. You can read it with me on the screen, or you can pick up your own Bible and read along. We'll notice in Genesis 1 and verse 1, it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was waste and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, there was morning, one day. And then in verse 6, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day. And then in verse 9, God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he seas, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth put forth grass, herbs yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit after their kind, wherein is the seed thereof upon the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, herbs yielding seed after their kind, trees bearing fruit, wherein is the seed thereof after their kind. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was a morning, a third day. In verse 14, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of heaven to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for the lights of the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, the lesser light to rule the night. And he made the stars also. And God set them in the firmament of heaven to give light upon the earth and to rule over the day and over the night and to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and morning, a fourth day. In verse 20, God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth in the open firmament of heaven. And God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moveth wherein the waters swarmed after their kind, and every winged bird after its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening, there was morning, a fifth day. Verse 24, God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things, and beasts of the earth after their kind, and it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the ground after its kind, and God saw that it was good. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. And God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them. And God said unto them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb yielding seed, which is upon the face of the earth, and every tree in which is the fruit of the tree yielding seed, to you it shall be for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for the food, and it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, there was a morning, the sixth day. And then we're going to read the first three verses of chapter 2. And the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all of his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because that in it he rested from his work which God had created and made. Now, as what we've just read, is it fact? Or is it fiction? Is it the truth? Or is it a fairy tale? Many of our educators, talk show hosts, religious leaders tell you that Genesis chapter 1 is nothing more than a fairy tale. Well, we're going to ask the question this morning, evolution. Is it fact or is it fiction? And in answering that question, we want to look at it in four parts. First of all, we want to define what evolution is. The most important thing we can do at the beginning of a discussion, in any public discussion, even in a private discussion or a debate, you need to define the proposition. And if you don't define the proposition, sometimes it's kind of like a dog chasing its tail. You just argue in circles because you really have not defined what it is we're talking about. And so it's so important to talk about evolution and what it is. And then we're going to talk about science versus evolution. And I think we're going to show you a great body of science that is opposed to evolution. And we want to then ask the question in the second part this morning, what about theistic evolution? Can you believe in evolution and believe in God, the God of the Bible, believe the Bible? We want to show you why you cannot. And then we want to take a few moments to look at the impact that evolution has upon society and, yes, even on the church. So what is evolution? When we talk about the word evolution, it's not using the word in the general sense of just saying things change. I mean, a lot of things change. What we're talking about is the general theory of organic evolution. And we need to understand it's not a fact like some people treat it. It's not a fact like gravity. It is absolutely just a theory. It's a theory that says this, that all living things have arisen by materialistic, naturalistic evolutionary process from a single source, which itself arose by a similar process from a dead inanimate world. This theory may also be called a molecule-to-man theory of evolution. In other words, we're talking about how did atoms turn into Adam? How does that cosmic goo, how did it turn into you? That's what we're talking about this morning. We're not talking about just change, people getting older and this sort of thing. No, we're talking about how did you have nothing and then have dead inanimate particles, and those dead inanimate particles turn into life, that first single cell beginning as evolutionist teaches, and then that give all forms of life, plant life, animal life, and human beings. That's what we are talking about. Charles Darwin wrote in Origin of Species, it is truly a wonderful fact. See, Darwin, even in the 1800s, was calling it a fact that all animals and all plants throughout all time and space should be related to each other. It's been a long time since I've lived in the Northwest. But I've observed a few things, and you're probably like where our capital is in Texas. Austin, Texas sits in the middle of Travis County. In Travis County, we sometimes, and the rest of the state, kind of laugh at them. We call them the tree huggers. I'm thinking y'all may have a few tree huggers up here. Now, I believe in taking care of the environment, but the very idea that I'm related, I mean biologically related to a Douglas fir tree, really, and that I'm related to insects and worms and this sort of thing as we talked about in that quotation last night, that's what evolution teaches. You had a single cell beginning, and then all plant life, animal life, human beings have all evolved from that. So this is a theory of organic evolution, and it should not be confused with the special theory of evolution, which really is a fact, and it only describes selective breeding or adaptation that takes place within a kind, within a genetically compatible kind. You see, within a kind, there's a lot of room for horizontal variation. For an example, we all know that you take a Cocker Spaniel, breed it with a poodle, end up with a Cockapoo. You can have a Pekingese, breed it with a poodle, and have a Peek-a-poo. And well, here's the bottom line. When you breed one dog with another dog, they may look differently. In fact, sometimes they look kind of funny. But you still just have a dog. You're not breeding dogs and turning them into mountain lions, into eagles, or other forms of animal life. There are 200 plus varieties of bluegrass, but they're all grass. There's some 300 plus varieties of perennial rye, but yet it's just rye. And there's 1,300 different varieties of roses, but ladies, a rose by any other name is still a rose. You don't have roses turning into oak trees, Douglas firs, loblolly pines. Roses remain roses. So here's the problem, and why I'm talking about this, and it's important for us to talk about it, is evolutionists very commonly do what is called bait and switch. Now, in the business world, bait and switch is a con game. And that game goes on in the scientific world. What evolutionists do is they show us the fact of horizontal variation within a kind. The fact that you can have adaptation within a kind. That's a special theory of evolution. And once they've done that, they say, see, that proves vertical evolution. One kind turning into another kind. A germ, an amoeba, turning into a human being. To show one kind of dog becoming another kind of dog does not show amoebas turning into human beings. But that's what they do all the time, and I'm going to show you an example of how they do that. And almost every biology textbook that deals with evolution you see this story. In fact, you see these pictures. And these pictures are showing a peppered moth. Now on the left-hand side, where you have a light-colored trunk, you see the lighter-colored peppered moth, kind of camouflaged, and then you have the dark kind of peppered moth. And over here we have a dark trunk. You see the same moths, but the dark one seems to be more camouflaged. And they tell the story that in England, before the Industrial Revolution, the trees were generally clean-looking. And then the Industrial Revolution came along, and the trees became very soot-filled and dark. And you had this population of moths that starts out with, say, 90% peppered moths that are light and about 10% that are dark. And after the trees get dark, then you have that demographic switch take place where there's a lot more of the dark ones and then the light ones. And then environmentalism takes over. They start cleaning up all of the smokestacks, putting out a lot less soot, and it goes back the other direction as these trees are light. And they say, see there, that proves evolution. Now, last night I said, one thing I hope that I can do before I leave is turn y'all into question askers. You see, when I see something like that, the first thing I want to do is I want to raise my hand. And basically just say, and your point is? You think about this. At the very beginning, let's say their story is true. At the very beginning, you don't have two different kinds of animals. You have one kind of animal. You have peppered moths. You have dark ones. You have light ones. I graduated from high school, from Dumas High School, in 1973. And in 1973, I left and I went off to college and then dental school, and I came back. In 1973, we probably had less than 10% Hispanic population, 0% black population in our town. Over the 7 years that I was gone, the population had a huge change. We had over 50% Hispanic population. In fact, today in the school system, we're about 77% Hispanic. You know, I enjoy that. I speak Spanish, and I enjoy the Hispanic culture. And so that's something that's always been something I've enjoyed. Now, what's going on there? Is that evolution? You know, if you believe this story to prove evolution, then you believe what's taking place in Dumas is evolution. But you know better than that. We just have people, and when we have other people that are different looking, act maybe a little bit differently, but they're still just people. So what caused that to happen? Well, while I was gone, there was a meatpacking plant came in, and it's pretty interesting. It became a place in which people could get jobs. If you wanted to work, there's jobs. You know, I was down in Portland, Oregon a few years ago doing this series of meetings, and the employment rate in Oregon at that time was about 15% unemployment. And I wasn't trying to get anybody to move, but I'm going to tell you, I've mentioned this to one of the elders. I said, here's the deal. In Dumas, there's always jobs. They're not all that pleasant working in a meatpacking plant, pretty tough work, but there's always jobs. And so there's people who are political refugees. When I moved back, people from Chile, people from Laos, people from Vietnam were there. We have other political refugees there now, and so we have a huge black population come in from the Sudan and from Somalia. We have Burmese there, and we are always having some change. But evolution's not taking place. That's not it. And this story is the same. First of all, nothing has changed except a demographic change. But you have to also ask a few questions. You see, so many times we listen to people, especially if they have a doctorate degree, and we just accept what they say as the truth. And you say, see how this is so much more camouflage, a lighter colored moth? Camouflage to what? To the human eye? You know, we're not the predators for peppered moths, first of all. And you have to think that the different senses that we have are different in animals that could be the predators. In fact, have you ever noticed that you can blow a whistle that no one, no human being can hear, and the dogs in the community will come running? Because their ears are different than ours. Different animals have different eyes than what we have. Up here in the Great Northwest, in fact, when you go on up into Alaska, you see so many eagles. And those eagles have the ability to be several hundred feet up in the air, or maybe in a perch, and they can look down and they can see fish under the water that you and I can't see just standing a few feet away from them. And you also understand that water changes the refraction of light, so the fish may look like it's here, but it's really over there. The eagle has the ability with the eyes that are superior to ours in this particular regard to be able to be several hundred feet up, look where the fish is, see it, make the calculation necessary to know exactly where it is, and dive and hit that fish every time. You see, their eyes are different from ours. So we just go ahead and assume, well, yeah, you know, this makes it camouflage. Well, not necessarily. And then you also have to ask the question, do pepper moths hang out on the trunks of trees? And the answer is no. There's only been a couple of times in history that we know of in which pepper moths have been on trees like this. And what a lot of people don't realize when you see this picture, this is a stage picture. These moths are dead. They have been pinned to the tree so they can get a picture. Pepper moths don't typically hang out on the trunks of trees. They typically hang out on the underneath side of leaves. What you're seeing here is a hoax that's put upon our children and upon you all of the time. But even if what they say is true, proves nothing at all. You started out with white and black, you end up with white and black, nothing has really changed. So, evolution is a theory. It's based on a lot of hoaxes. And you also need to understand it's not a scientific theory. And you say, wait a second, not a scientific theory? I thought scientists tell this story. Yeah, that's right. But not every story that scientists tell is a scientific theory. I'm a scientist. Do you think I can just come up with any theory I want to and expect the public to believe it because since I'm a scientist, it makes it a scientific theory? No. For a theory to be scientific, it must go through the scientific method. Every research team that I've been on, we think about the scientific method. And that's what true scientists do. You first of all need to be able to check what you're looking at by looking at it one way or another by observing it. It must be supported by events, processes, or properties that can be observed, and it must be capable of falsification. In fact, you need to be able to come up with an experiment that disproves this theory. That's what falsification is about. And really, if you truly understand science, science is less about proving things true. It's more about trying to disprove things, and if you can't disprove them, you feel better about them likely being true. And that's what falsification is about. So it's on this basis evolution subject to creation being considered a scientific theory. And I agree. Creation is not a scientific theory. You cannot observe it. Why did I read Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, 1 through 3? So you could understand what God said He did in the past and how He said He finished it. It is over. Creation is not going on. We're in the creation, but God is no longer creating. It's a historical event. A historical event. Therefore, you cannot observe creation taking place. But evolution claims to be an ongoing process. And since it's an ongoing process, they say we ought to be able to observe it. Evolution is unproven. It's not subject to the experimental method. And if evolution is not a historical fact and not a scientific theory, what is it? It's a philosophy on the origin of the universe. It's a philosophy on the origin of life. It's a philosophy that says if you would take a frog and instantaneously turn it into a prince, that would be a nursery tale. However, give them 300 million years, and it should be considered a fact that you can go from a frog to the prince. That's what this theory is. We noticed this quote last night. Professor George Wald, a PhD biochemist teaching biology at Harvard, Nobel Prize winner, said time is in fact the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible, the possible probable, and the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait. Time itself performs miracles. Professor Wall says time performs miracles. So when you look at evolution, what is it? It is a theory, a philosophy on the origin of life that requires miracles. A philosophy on the origin of life that requires miracles is what? It's a religion. And I wrote an article one time about how evolution truly is a religion. But that concept's not unique to me. You can see all sorts of scientists that are well noted that will say the exact same thing. Professor Louis Bonior, former president of the Biological Society in Strasbourg, wrote, "Evolutionism is a fairy tale for grown-ups. This theory has helped nothing in the progress of science. It is useless." Dr. Tien Tasmissian of the Atomic Energy Commission wrote, "Scientists who go about teaching that evolution is a fact of life are great con men, and the story they're telling may be the greatest hoax ever. In explaining evolution, we do not have one iota of fact." There's no facts to support evolution. H.S. Lipson, professor of physics in the United Kingdom, said, "In fact, evolution became, in a sense, a scientific religion. Almost all scientists have accepted it, and many are prepared to bend their observations to fit in with it." What is evolution? It's a religion. Sir Arthur Keith, you know, he wrote the foreword to the 100th anniversary edition of Darwin's book, Origin of Species. You don't get that privilege without being a very noted evolutionist. And yet, what does Sir Arthur Keith say? Evolution's unproved. And it's unprovable. We believe it only because the only alternative is special creation, and that is unthinkable. The only reason we believe in evolution, Sir Arthur Keith says, is because it's unthinkable to think of creation. Why is it unthinkable? I'll tell you why it's unthinkable. Because if creation took place, that means there is a creator, there is a God. A God in charge of this universe. A God that we need to submit to. And when you don't want to submit to somebody else, you don't want to follow their rule, you want to live any way you want to live, then it's just unthinkable. Think you'd have to change the way you're living now to live the way a God would want you to live. Evolution is a religion that is atheism. Again, there's always only been two choices. Either God made it, or there hasn't been a God and it made itself. Evolution is a religion that contradicts the two most basic laws of science. Every field of science agrees that the two most basic laws of science are the first and the second laws of thermodynamics. That first law says that energy can be converted from one form to another, but it cannot be created, nor can it be destroyed. Now, if you can't destroy energy, why do you ever have a problem with not enough energy? An energy crisis. Well, that brings us to the second law. We call the second law of thermodynamics the law of entropy, and the word entropy essentially means disorder. It says that the total amount of entropy or disorder is always increasing. Let's put it another way. This law demands that in any energy transfer, whether it is atomic, whether it's chemical, whether it's physical, there's always a certain amount of energy made unavailable for further use. Even though our cars are designed with a system to keep trying to recycle that gasoline, and the catalytic converter is the end stage of that process, even though that is true, sooner or later you have to fill up with gasoline because you can't keep burning the same gasoline. You have a fireplace and you put logs in it, you can't keep burning the same logs. After a while, the logs and change in another form where you have to put new logs in. This law says that the universe is running down, it is wearing out. Evolution says, no, give us time. This world is getting better and better and more organized and more sophisticated all the time and all by itself. Evolution assumes that adding energy, which would be an open system, will overcome the second law of thermodynamics. Well, first of all, this universe is a closed system. The universe is everything that there is, with nothing else. And adding energy is destructive unless you've got a complex machinery to organize it, to harness it, and do something productive with it. I'm going to give you an example. The Japanese came over to Pearl Harbor in 1941, and they added a lot of energy to Pearl Harbor, and nothing was organized. Just putting energy to it did not make things better. And then, what did we do? We went to Japan to end World War II, and we put atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We gave a whole lot of energy to those areas, and we didn't make anything better. We destroyed things. Unless there is a specific, complex mechanism to organize energy, things don't just get better. You leave your car out in the sun, after a while, what's going to happen to the vinyl top? You're putting energy to it. It's not making it better. It's wearing it out. In fact, it'll wear out your paint job. It'll wear out the roof on your house. In fact, it'll just destroy a building altogether. Given enough time, just putting energy on it does not make it better. And that's true of the animal and the human kind. You look at us when we're young. You got Sue at 20. But what does Sue look like at 90 with more energy at her? And if you think that's something, look at Sue at 3,000. You see? Just giving time and adding energy does not make things better at all. Evolution is a religion that contradicts the two most basic laws of science. It contradicts the law of biogenesis. The law of biogenesis says to have life, you have to have life. Evolution says no. We can have life, and we did, without any life at all originally. Evolution preaches the false concept of spontaneous generation, that something can come from nothing. Louis Pasteur in the 1800s proved that that is absolutely not true. But up until that point in time, people thought that something could come from nothing. Evolution evangelizes by academic peer pressure. And that's why it's so important for churches and parents to have times where you have meetings and Bible studies on subjects such as this. Because let me tell you, when our children go off to school, you know what happens? These people just tell you evolution is a fact. They're not necessarily trying to convince you. They just teach it as a fact. And our kids go off to school and they look at people who have such educated backgrounds. And they compare that to where they came from sometimes. And I don't know how many people I personally know who have totally lost their faith. My freshman year in college, I sat down at the feet of a preacher where he was teaching me how to become a better young preacher. And he told me with tears the story about how his son had gone off to the University of Texas to study chemistry and become an atheist. That is not an isolated situation. I've had people that I've taught in Bible classes that have gone off to school and universities, and they think, you know what, these guys are right, these guys are so educated, and they totally lose their faith. That's why it's so important for us to spend time talking about this, because academic peer pressure, the idea that if you don't believe this, you're just a dummy. And you see it all the time, don't you? If a politician is reported by the media to actually believe in creation versus evolution, it's a headline basically saying, this guy, this politician's an idiot. How could anybody believe in creation? Only idiots believe in creation. And that's what our media does. That's what our society does. And really, I think the evidence is so strong in the other direction. Pierre Chardin, a Catholic priest, wrote evolution as a general postulate to which all theories, all hypotheses must henceforth bow. In order to be thinkable and true, evolution is a light which illuminates all facts, which all lines of thought must follow. That is what evolution is. And when he said all lines of thought, evolution affects every academic discipline that there is, without exception. I was giving this series of presentations here at the University of Oklahoma a few years ago, and there's a young man who'd been a full-time preacher. He's going back to school to get a master's degree in English. And after seeing this quotation, he came up to me after the lesson. He said, "That is so true. Even in the English department, we are inundated with evolution." To think that you have to study evolution to be an English professor. But it affects every line of study. Richard Dawkins, in Put Your Money on Evolution, said it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, that person's ignorant, stupid, or insane. He said that's really what the general population has been taught to believe by people who are noted to being scientists. Hitler said this: if you tell a lie long enough, loud enough, and often enough, the people will believe it. And he also said, people are more likely to believe a big lie than a small one. What is evolution? It is a big lie. It is a scientific religion. And it's not based in fact. It's not based in science. And so what I want to do is want to talk about science against evolution. First of all, when you go to school, you never, ever see an evolutionist talk about how he can prove evolution mathematically. You know why? Because mathematics so disproves evolution. And I want you to think about some simple math. What are the odds that unthinking molecules can turn themselves into thinking human beings? That's the question, is it not? That unthinking molecules can become thinking human beings? Is it mathematically possible? Let's do a math problem without even looking at numbers. Take sugar, flour, baking soda, egg, all the things that you have to have in order to have a cake. Just throw them on the floor together. How many times do you have to run an experiment in order to come up with a cake? It's never going to happen. It's mathematically impossible. Let's take another one. Let's take all the components you need to have a fine automobile. Or maybe just a fundamentally simple automobile. Take steel, rubber, glass, plastic. Put it all together in a concrete mixer. And turn that mixer on and just start cranking all the parts. How long will it take you to crank that concrete mixer before a car comes out the other end? You go, well, that's never going to happen. And you're exactly right. It's mathematically impossible. But that's really what the evolutionist does. He says, I'm going to take all these chemicals, we're going to mix them up, we're going to let them mix themselves up, and sooner or later you're going to get life. It's kind of like one of my colleagues told a joke one time. He was talking about that this atheist was talking to God, and he said, you know, I can do what you've done. He said, I can come up with life. And God said, well, let's see you try. And so he reaches down to get some dirt, and the Lord says, oh no, you've got to start out by making your own dirt. You see, you have to give them everything. How did this world evolve itself? How did something come out of essentially nothing? I really can't explain that, but if you just kind of generally talk about it, then it makes sense, because they say, if you don't believe that, you're just not very smart. So how much more intelligence would it take to design life? Brilliant scientists have tried to do it. And so far, they have not been able to do it. So how could blind, stupid chance come up with life? Now let's talk about numbers. Is evolution mathematically possible? When we talk about probability, we're talking about permutations. But we're going to make this real simple. Let's take some pennies. And let's take a March lot, a Sharpie, and let's just number the pennies. So we're going to put on one penny the number one, then number two, three, and we're going to, if you have 200 pennies, we're going to have, each one will have its own number all the way out to 200. If I would take one penny, put it in my pocket, what are the odds that I could reach in there with blind chance and come out with that the first time? 100%. But if I take penny one and two, put them in my pocket, and with blind chance, what are the odds that I can get them in the order of number one, then number two on the first try? Well, that's 50%. I take three pennies. I put them in my pocket, and by blind chance, I want to try to pull them out number one, two, and three. Then it's only one chance in six. If it's four, it's one chance in 24. Do you see how, as the pennies get more in number, how it's dramatically more impossible to come up with that by blind chance? If you have just 100 pennies, then the odds of doing that all in order, 1 through 100, is only 1 chance in 10 to the 158th power. 200 parts is only 1 chance in 10 to the 375th power. And now you ask yourself the question, is there anything that's that complicated? And keep in mind, the mathematicians tell us that anything that doesn't have a better chance of 1 times 10 to the 50th is mathematically impossible. You only have to have 42 parts to come up with that. Anything that only has 42 parts is mathematically impossible. Can you think of anything in the world that's that complicated to have 42 parts or more? as in almost everything. Yeah. So, consider a simple 200 part system. If the universe has been here 10 billion years, how long has it been here in seconds? That's 1 times 10 to the 18th power. A 200 part system, then, if you ran this chance, I'm talking about taking all 200 pennies out, laying them out, seeing if I got them in the right order, pulling them out one at a time, every second. And you're going, well, Bonner, you can't do that in a second. Yeah, I can with a computer, with a random number generator. And so I can use a random number generator. We run this experiment every single second for the theoretical number of seconds in the universe of 1 times 10 to the 18th. And it's still only one chance in 10 to the 357th power. Way beyond 1 times 10 to the 50th. Way beyond anything that's mathematically possible at all. And there are so many things to have more than 200 parts. The human skeleton has over 200 parts. In the adult, it's come down to 206 bones. There's not enough time for the human skeleton to evolve, much less the human brain that has been estimated to have 86 billion neurons that all have to be lined up in the right order, or it just doesn't function. And someone says, wait a second, we're not saying that the skeleton evolves by itself. We're starting out with a single cell. And when they say that, my smile gets bigger and bigger. I'm going, you're making my point. Because it becomes more and more mathematically impossible. So someone says, well, we're talking about starting out with a single cell. If you'll read Darwin's work, he didn't call it the single cell. He called it the simple cell. And the reason he called it the simple cell is he knew almost nothing about biology compared to even freshman biology students in college today. You look at a typical cell. Is it possible mathematically for a single cell to evolve? You know, a typical cell has about a quadrillion atoms. Carl Sagan himself, a noted evolutionist, said the information content of a simple cell, he's using Darwin's terminology, has been established as around 1 times 10 to the 12th bits, comparable to 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. A single cell is so highly complicated. Today, in college, you know how long it takes to teach cell biology? First of all, you have to understand biochemistry. And then cell biology is a 2-semester course taught to those who are graduating seniors in the biology department. There's nothing simple about a single cell. Cell biology is extremely complicated. But let's go back to something less complicated. Let's say you place bets with an evolutionist on a coin toss. And you flip 30 straight heads. Would he believe it? He'd say, well, I think you're cheating. Now, we're just talking about tossing coins and getting 30 in a row like we used to call them out. You know what? If you did 60 times in a row, he'd probably want to shoot you if you had any money on it. And don't misunderstand, I'm not advocating betting. But the same evolutionist with batting an eye believes that something that is infinitely less probable did take place. It's kind of like the cosmic casino came up with straight royal flushes time and time again. Evolution is mathematically impossible. There's not enough time in the universe. That's what I made the statement last night. You give them 10 billion, you give them 20 billion, you haven't even started to have enough time. You give them 1 billion years. Not enough time. Just mathematically impossible. We talked about this a little bit last night, the geologic time column, how they try to give you the idea that you can take a drilling rig and just drill down through the crust of the universe, and that's a historic representation of how life evolved. What I want to do is I want you to focus on this very bottom level of the geologic column referred to as the Cambrian and the Precambrian. That's all you really need to know to appreciate some quotations I want to show you. There's several huge problems with this geologic column. You see, that geologic column is supposed to represent in history this biologic tree. This is what we've been talking about, how evolutionists tell us that an amoeba was the first life, or a one-cell organism like an amoeba, and then all plant life, animal life, and human life evolved from this single-cell beginning. So when you go back and you look at the geologic column, this is supposed to be the history of this biologic tree. Now, We look at very noted evolutionists. Stephen Jay Gould, Harvard professor, says evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference. However reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. Not the evidence of fossils. He says you look at these biologic trees out here at the nodes, the tips, well, we see that. How we got from the single cell beginning to that is not based upon evidence. We have no evidence from fossils on that at all. Dr. Colin Patterson, senior paleontologist at the British Museum of Natural History, said, I fully agree with your comments on that lack of evolutionary transitions in my book. I made this statement last night, how there are no transition forms from one kind to another. Dr. Patterson said, you're talking about my book, how I didn't put any transition forms in there? He said, if I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. I'll lay it on the line, there is not one such fossil. There are no transition forms. David Ropp wrote, in the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, they have not been found. Yet the optimism has died hard with some pure fantasy has crept into textbooks. Evolutionists are admitting that this is fantasy that's been written in the textbooks. Dott and Batten wrote, we have arranged the groups in a traditional way with the simplest forms first and progressively more complex forms following. This particular arrangement is arbitrary and depends upon what definition of complexity you wish to choose. I'll give you an example. The trilobite is a fossil. It's supposed to be an indexed fossil for about 400 million years ago. And when you look at the fossil eye of a trilobite, very complex. In some ways, far more complex than the human eye. We've already referred to an eagle's eye and what the eagle needs more complex than ours. But for what we need, more complex than theirs. It's arbitrary. Which one's more complicated? W. Swinton of the British Museum of Natural History said the evolutionary origin of the bird is a matter of deduction. There's no fossil evidence of the stages which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. And that's what evolutionists have generally taught, that you have reptiles that turn into birds. But there's no fossil evidence of that. So the second problem with this geologic column is the actual content. Richard Dawkins said, and we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution, the very first time they appear, it's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Dawkins says, when you look at the geologic column, what do you see? He says, needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. He says, when you look at the geologic column, you see what the creationists say ought to be there. So what's there? What we say should be there. It supports creation, not evolution. Richard Monastrycki said, the remarkably complex forms of animals we see suddenly appeared. This moment right at the start of the Earth's Cambrian period marks the evolutionary explosion that filled the seas of the Earth's first complex creatures. This is Genesis material. Where do you start seeing complexity? The bottom layer, the Cambrian layer, and it supports creation. Stephen Jay Gould said the Cambrian explosion occurred in a geologic moment, and we have reason to think that all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. Where? The very lowest level of the geologic column. Not only the phylum Chordata itself, but all its major divisions. The phylum Chordata is where we as human beings are classified. This is all the major divisions of our phylum is found in the very bottom layer of the geologic column. He also said, since the so-called Cambrian explosion, no new phyla of animals have entered the fossil record. Discoverer stated the large animal phyla today were present already in the early Cambrian and that they're as distinct from each other as they are today. What does the geologic column show? Evidence for creation, not evolution. Here's the third problem. It's how you get the dates for the geologic column. We talked about this in great detail last night, but I want to make a few notes. Niles Elder says this poses something of a problem. If we date the rocks by the fossils, how can we then turn around and talk about patterns of evolutionary change through time in the fossil record? Niles Eldridge admits that it's certain to reason. If you date the fossils by the rocks and date the rocks by the fossils, that's a problem, and it doesn't prove anything at all. Is this right? Geologic textbooks tell us that stalagmites and stalactites form at the rate of thousands of years per cubic inch. Obviously, at such slow rates, it'd take a long time for them to form. Now, if you didn't watch them form, how do you know how long it took? But people want to impress us that these take long periods of time. The George Rogers Clark Memorial, built on the bank of the Wabash River, you go down to the basement of this memorial, and when this building is only 40 years old, what do you see? Huge stalactites and stalagmites. It only took 40 years or less to form. When you see a stalagmite or stalactite, we don't know how long it took. It could take a long time. It could take a short time. What you see is deposition taking place, and the water that has lime is laying it down. Have you ever been in a restroom where they didn't keep it clean? And stalagmites start growing? Because there's lime in the water? Yeah. It doesn't take that long. Fourth problem for evolution is with the geologic column is the process of fossilization itself. What does the fossilization indicate? It indicates rapid catastrophe, not vast periods of time. Dunbar Rogers said, to some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery that billions of years presented a dilemma. For if the known stratified rocks had been accumulating throughout this vast span of time, the average rate of depositions must have been extremely slow. And yet there's very good evidence it accumulated rapidly. So what are we talking about? Think of a shrimp. This is seafood country. My wife grew up on the Gulf Coast. You get fresh shrimp. You leave a few out, but you forget to cook. How long does it take for them to be just totally destroyed? They decompose so quickly. And yet here you see fossilized shrimp in great detail. How did that happen? Did it have thousands of years for that fossil to take place? No. You've got this shrimp, and it's covered up, pressurized, fossilized very quickly. And this is not an exception to the rule. You look at a fern. When I was a little kid living in Portland, Oregon, there was an area right across the street from our house that we used to call the forest. And I'd go over there, and under the Douglas fir trees, there were ferns. And I would cut them off, and I'd bring them back to our house, and I'd put them in water. But you know what would take place. Within just an hour or two or three, the fronds would just start curling up, even though they're in water. Here is a fossilized fern. Not curling up, not decomposing. It took place, this fossilization process, very, very quickly. Now, how did that take place? I would suggest that a lot of fossils were probably formed during the worldwide flood, during the time of Noah. Now, it wouldn't just be Noah's time in which you could have fossils take place. You could have local catastrophes. But the worldwide catastrophe of the flood would explain a lot of fossilization. These fossilized fish, where the details are obvious, are so in abundance, you can go into stores all over the United States and buy these fossils. I have some in my desk at home. It's interesting to see all these fossilized fish. Some of them fossilized in the process of swallowing another fish. And here's another example of that. When you see fossils, you don't necessarily see long periods of time. That's an assumption people are putting upon us to believe. Reminds me of when we went to the Museum of Natural History, that's now part of West Texas A&M University, there in Canyon, Texas. Our children were in preschool. And we went along as parents that were helping keep an eye on the kids. And I'm sitting in the back of the room, and there was a graduate student there at West Texas. It was West Texas State University at that time. And she is showing the kids how she believed fossils were formed. they had a sandbox and they had these cattle bones. And they said, you see these bones? They represent like a dinosaur's bones. She didn't say they were. She wasn't lying on that point. But she said, what takes place is a dinosaur would die. And then over a long period of time, dirt gets blown in and covers it up. And you have a fossil dinosaur form. Anybody want to raise their hand? Ask a question. I'm sitting in the back of the room and I'm thinking, I grew up in cowboy country. In fact, where I live now is major cowboy country. There's like three stages of raising cattle. The last stage is the feed yard stage where you fatten them up for market. If you take a compass point, put it in Amarillo, Texas, and go out 200 miles and just draw a circle, a third of all the cattle in this country in that circle. I live in cowboy country. And I'm sitting there thinking, not a cowboy I know would believe that story. You think about it. A cow dies. Does he lay there in the pasture for thousands of years? And we live in windy country where lots of wind and dirt blow in. In fact, sometimes you see sandhills move along. Would it just be there for thousands of years to be covered up and turned into a fossil? No. You have all sorts of predators. Some of those are from the air. You've got all sorts of buzzards come in. You've got coyotes. You've got other predators who are going to go gnaw off a leg, haul it off somewhere else. But even if none of those existed, just the bacteria decomposes a dead cow really pretty quickly. So it doesn't take thousands of years. When you see a fossil, usually you're seeing a rapid catastrophe in evidence. A jellyfish, an animal that's as next to nothing as you possibly can see, and yet we have fossilized jellyfish all over the world. Fossils show rapid catastrophe, not long periods of time. Here's a fifth problem that evolutionists have with the geologic column, and I have never heard them talk about this, and it's that of polystrate fossils, where you have a fossil in a fossil, or a fossil in a fossilized layer. Dunbar Rogers wrote, internal evidence in the strata, however, belies these estimates. The cold measures of Nova Scotia, for an example, the stumps and trunks of many trees are preserved standing upright as they grew, clearly having been buried before they had time to fall or rot away. Here, sediment certainly accumulated to a depth of many feet within a few years. Cookeville, Tennessee. I was just out in Cookeville, giving this series of lessons. And out in Cookeville, Tennessee, there is a fossilized tree in this fossilized layer. This tree is about 30 feet tall. The bottom part of it is in coal. The top part is in shale. And it makes you ask some questions like, how did the tree get there? Certainly it didn't grow through the coal and the shale. It grew, and this is all laid down very quickly. And you think about it, it had to be quickly, because the theory behind coal formation is this. You'll take about 10 to 11 feet of fresh vegetation, squash it, and pressurize it into 1 foot. Now you've got a foot of peat. Take 7 or 8 feet of peat, squash it down, pressurize it, and even heat it, and now you've got a foot of coal. So now we've got about 10, 11, 12 foot of coal that this tree is surrounded by on the bottom, and then the shale. What could cause it? Some sort of catastrophe. And it might have been the worldwide flood, but it could have been another kind of catastrophe that would do that. But when you see these polystrate fossils, and if you talk to coal miners, they will tell you in these coal mines there are trees throughout these coal mines all the time. What does this show? When you see the geologic column, they don't grow trees through it, do they? It kind of blows the idea of how long it took to lay down this strata. What about dinosaurs? Do they prove evolution? Evolutionists say that dinosaurs evolved and became extinct 70 million years before man evolved. The Bible says man and all animals were created in the last 2 days of creation. That would have man coexisting with dinosaurs. The Bible seems to mention dinosaurs in Job 40. It talks about the behemoth. It has a tail like a cedar. Unfortunately, there are some translations that called it a hippopotamus. A hippopotamus has a little tail, not a tail like a cedar. And he talks about this animal being in the middle of the Jordan during flood stage, and he raises his head up. I'm thinking this could have been like an apatosaurus. The huge flood waters would rush on him and around him, and it wouldn't bother him at all. and his head would raise up above it all and not be disturbed. It looks like a dinosaur to me in that particular passage of Scripture. Havasupai Canyon, near the Grand Canyon, or part of the Grand Canyon, Arizona, there are Indian pictographs of all sorts of animals. And one that looks kind of like a dinosaur. And you think about it, the word dinosaur wasn't even coined about 1841. And yet these Indians were looking at some animals that may have been dinosaurs, or some that certainly appeared to them as a dinosaur. In the Paluxy River in Texas, there have been found human and dinosaur footprints very close together, and sometimes on top of one another. How did these form? When I was finishing up college there at Stephen F. Austin State University, I was taking herpetology. And my professor of herpetology one afternoon was talking about this very place. He says, you know, at the Paluxy River, there are these human footprints that are next to and with the dinosaur footprints. Any questions? I had to raise my hand. He says, Bonner, what's your question? I said, well, Dr. Rainwater, didn't you tell us that dinosaurs became extinct 70 million years before man evolved? Well, yeah. I said, what's your explanation for these footprints being together? He said, you know, I had never thought about that. You know, I think that was pretty interesting in and of itself. That you're getting ready to tell the story in a classroom and you've never thought about the obvious consequences. I said, well, now that you've thought about it, what? How would you explain it? He said, I don't think there is a good explanation. So I just nodded my head in agreement. And then he said, well, you know what? There must have been a mammal back in that period of time that had a foot about the size of a human being. Now these tracks have been laid down, many of them about a size 12 foot, my size. When you think about that, according to modern evolutionary theory, during the time of the dinosaurs, the biggest mammal was about the size of a big rat. And you've got a big rat, it's bipedal, walking on just two, and he's got the foot the size of a size 12 human being, and putting those strides out like a human being would stride. Takes a little bit of imagination to come up with that, doesn't it? The Bible says that they were made on the same day. Charles Darwin wrote this. If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would be absolutely breakdown. You know, Darwin said it right. Show me one thing that couldn't evolve. Just one, and the whole theory is gone. And I would suggest to Darwin, every biological organism disproves your theory. We'll close this morning's segment with just asking you to consider the bombardier beetle. The bombardier beetle has a highly specialized defense system to repulse ants, spiders, frogs, and praying mantis. It's got a tail. It's almost like a machine gun. What's interesting about this tail is it has glands that manufacture chemicals. Has storage compartments that the chemicals are stored in. At the right time, these chemicals are squeezed into a mixing chamber. When they're squeezed together and mixed up, they reach the temperature of boiling water, 212 degrees Fahrenheit, 100 degrees Celsius. They're very noxious. Then he takes his tail and he's able to aim it. And in kind of a staccato fashion, kind of like a machine gun, he aims it wherever he wants to get rid of the predator. So you have to ask the question about the prototype. The prototype bombardier that evolved. What came first? The glands? With no storage compartments? The storage compartments without the glands? Maybe the glands and the storage compartments evolved, but they didn't have the mixing chamber. But what about the machine gun? Without that, he couldn't use any of it. Or maybe he evolved the machine gun first, and then he got the glands and the mixing compartment and the storage compartment. You see, biology shows great organization, design. When I was teaching anatomy and physiology at our local college, I didn't have to ever mention God. There's so many times we'd have PowerPoint of the design of the human body, and I'd sit back and I'd look at the screen, and I'd say, just think about the design behind all of that. You could hear my entire class go, how could anybody not believe in God? The design of living things shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that we are a product of God and of His creation.